May it please the court, counsel. Alan Epstein, number 10473, on behalf of defendants Kathy and Ronald Whaley. The first issue on appeal is whether the trial court erred in precluding defendants' counsel from examining defendants immediately after plaintiff played their videotaped depositions to the jury. Defendants contend that the trial court erred as a matter of law and so precluding defendants from testifying, and that the error was prejudicial and reversible, not harmless. Ordinarily, when a party calls an adverse party as a witness, in his case in chief, under Rule 611, the witness may then be immediately cross-examined by his own attorney as a matter of course. The question of first impression in this case is whether a defendant is entitled to be cross-examined live after having his deposition presented to the jury by the plaintiffs in their case.
Isn't this like any other case of hearsay evidence being admitted, and therefore, you know, hearsay is admitted and the party can rebut it or dwell on it in their case in chief?
I'm sorry,
hearsay. Is it not an out-of-state court, out-of-court statement that's being offered into evidence, the deposition?
The issue is not hearsay, though. The issue is the timing of...
I understand it. Now, is it or is it not a hearsay statement? How about that? Is it a hearsay statement?
It is not a hearsay statement because it is not an out of court declaration by someone other than a party.
Okay. Is it an out of court statement offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted?
Yes.
Okay. In the normal course of things, when hearsay comes in, they don't allow the hearsay declarant to then take the stand to rebut whatever was said in the hearsay or to clarify anything that was said in the hearsay. Why would we want to vary from that procedure in this case just because it's a different form of hearsay?
If the objection is hearsay, it either is or is not admissible.
Talking about the procedure attending the admission of hearsay. Hearsay is admitted. Then, is the party, the declarant, entitled to say, but I want to take the stand right now, in the middle of your case in chief, in the normal course of business, can the declarant stand up and say, I demand to testify right now in the middle of your case in chief?
No.
Okay. It's not a question of the admission of hearsay. It's a question of what procedure attends this particular type of hearsay. And that's why I want to ask, why would you have a procedure that would vary from the normal way in which hearsay is admitted, treated, and responded to?
Because the rules that control this issue are Rule of Procedure 32 and Rule of Evidence 611. And the question is whether a party whose deposition is presented to the jury instead of being called live by the adverse party is entitled to present their cross-examination live, as if the opposing party had called them and testified live on direct, which is what happened here. The defendants were present and available to testify, but plaintiff's counsel instead played their videotaped depositions in plaintiff's case in chief because to gain a strategic advantage, because during those depositions, which were discovery depositions, defense counsel did not have the incentive to cross-examine.
Mr. Epstein, assuming we buy your argument, we agree that the trial court erred, why shouldn't we conclude that any error was harmless, especially in this case where the trial was very short, where the Whaleys themselves concede that their testimony would not have differed, and the facts are not particularly complex? We're talking about a bicycle automobile accident. Why shouldn't we say any error was harmless?
Well, the issue is not what was said, but when it was said and how it was said. And the ramifications of the court's decision go beyond this case. In this case, the defendants took the stand 2 days after their depositions were played in plaintiff's case in chief. But what about a complex case, a medical malpractice case, in which the defense is not going to be presented until 2 or 3 weeks later?
But, Mr. Epstein, excuse me for interrupting you, but you argue in your brief that this procedure that the judge used here was severely prejudicial to the Whaleys. And can you explain how it was prejudicial? Because they did have the opportunity to testify in person, albeit 2 days later.
Because their depositions were played instead of being called live, because plaintiff's counsel perceived that it would put them in a bad light. It's not what was said, but how it was said and when it was said. And again, because they were not cross-examined by defense counsel, since it was a discovery deposition and defendants already knew what plaintiffs were going to discover, the impression of the defendants was allowed to gel in the jury's mind for 2 days before they were put on the stand. It's a question of fairness. It is not fair to allow the plaintiffs to employ this tactic without allowing the defense to employ the rules of civil procedure and the rules of evidence to create a level playing field.
Let me ask you about a level playing field on that, counsel, because in the normal course, when you testify live, you know, you're asked questions, you spontaneously respond, and some answers may or may not be favorable, and then, you know, the other lawyer gets up to examine, I guess in your instance, your client, to try to rebut or at least mitigate some of the harm in the spontaneous direct examination. You're positing that someone has a right to immediately take the stand, not to respond to spontaneous examination, but to respond to something for which they already have of record and can pretty much evaluate and thank you.
but not until 2 days later.
No, you're positing that you should have the right to immediately take the stand following the deposition, which has been taken weeks, months, I don't know, sometime before trial. You know the contents of the deposition, and so you're not really reacting, your client's not really reacting to spontaneously developed testimony.
Well, it really isn't any different than it would have been had the defendant's depositions been taken and both parties had the chance to review what that testimony was. It's true that the defense had the opportunity to develop a strategy and how to respond to what was said in the depositions, but that's always the case. The question is in most instances that would be true if they were called live. Defense counsel knows what plaintiff's counsel is going to ask for the most part, but they then have the defense counsel then has the opportunity to immediately get up and ask the questions that rehabilitate the defendant immediately, so that again the jury's impression isn't gelled before they get the opportunity.
But Mr. Epstein, in this case, you haven't identified, or your client has not identified for this court, where that misimpression happened or what it was that needed to be rebutted or refuted or responded to contemporaneously. You just make this abstract argument without saying, this is what the client said and this is how we would have responded to it had we been given that opportunity to have immediate cross-examination.
That's always going to be true. After a videotaped deposition is taken of the defendants, defense counsel then has the opportunity prior to trial to mount a defense to what was said. Again, the question is not what was said, it's how it was said and when it was said.
You've told us that before the jury had an opportunity, or before the jury's impression gelled, but you haven't told us what that impression was and what it was that was so harmful that came out during the deposition that needed responding to.
It's subjective. The plaintiff's counsel would not have played defendant's videotaped depositions in plaintiff's case in chief when they were sitting right there unless the impression that was imparted by the deposition was negative. That's why. Whether it was body language, how the questions were answered, it's a subjective issue.
Couldn't have been because of what the defendants had said on that deposition? In other words, maybe they made some admissions on that deposition, or perhaps were caught in some inconsistencies on that deposition? In other words, not just the body language, but what they said on the deposition?
I don't think that's the case here. No, I don't think that's the case here. But again, the issue presented in this case goes beyond this case. If plaintiff's counsel are, if this strategy is condoned, then the discovery process could very well be protracted in a lot of cases, because if defense counsel is aware that their client's videotaped depositions can be played.
We've always wanted to add atmosphere to this.
Thank you. Nobody's ever shut the lights.
Nothing subliminal.
If defense counsel anticipates that their client's videotaped depositions are going to be played in plaintiff's case in chief, then they will have the incentive to make every discovery deposition a preservation deposition, so that the questions that plaintiff's counsel ask can be rebutted immediately in the deposition. That will protract the discovery process and make a discovery deposition a preservation deposition.
Counsel, how do you respond to the suggestion that your opponent makes that most depositions are transcribed by a court reporter? In this case, it was noticed as a videotaped deposition, so the fact that they're specifically noticing it as a videotaped deposition puts you more on notice that, in fact, they may use that videotape during the trial. How do you respond to that?
Because when preservation depositions are noticed, they are noticed as preservation depositions. That's the typical course of events that occurs. Videotape depositions are taken all the time.
Does Rule 32 differentiate between one and the other?
It does not. This is just a matter of common practice.
So the party does have an opportunity to examine at a discovery deposition. They just may choose not to.
Sure, and they typically choose not to as a matter of strategy, and because, again, it's a discovery deposition, and there's nothing for the defense to discover.
What's unfair about saying, basically, the deposition can come on, since you had the opportunity to ask questions but didn't, you can present your testimony with respect to that in your own case in chief? What's unfair about that?
Because if they had been called live, they would have been able to get up and...
They weren't called live. It was not spontaneous. It was an out-of-court statement.
What's unfair is that the jury is left with the impression from the videotaped deposition that didn't include cross-examination for 2 days or 2 weeks or even 2 months. Thank you. I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, good afternoon. I'm Jim Heckert. I represent the Raniers, and my number is 37230. I was initially going to stand on my brief on these issues, but I just can't help myself. I wanted to launch in, with your permission, into my cross appeal, but I did want to say that in addition to what Judge Daly brought up about the spontaneity of the live examination and cross-examination, and the situation of where in a deposition they do have several months to come up with an answer to that. They also have, with a deposition, the deponents have 30 days to make any corrections, which is another thing I think would be a consideration into with respect to the use of the deposition. Also, I've been trying lawsuits, civil cases, for over 35 years, and I have always used Rule 32A2 and have put in the deposition of an opposing party under that rule. It's not meant as any particular strategy or to hold my opponents in bad light, but it's to get the facts in the case. There was nothing about their body language or anything else. It was the facts of what Mrs. Whaley had to say.
Mr. Heckert, do you have an unqualified right to introduce the deposition of the opposing parties in the trial?
Well, Your Honor, there's some case law that would indicate that maybe in unusual circumstances, no, but I would suggest that Rule 32 A2 says yes, that you do. That it says that the deposition of an opposing party or managing agent may be introduced to trial for any purpose. And I believe that's unqualified, sir.
Well, let me follow up and then ask you a question that troubled me about your brief, because you said that normally discovery depositions, as Mr. Epstein just said, do not have questions asked by the lawyer for his or her own client. And you're suggesting in your brief, well, that maybe that should be done in anticipation of lawyers using Rule 32 to introduce depositions. But if that were to be the case, wouldn't that just extend the length of depositions over and above what they are now?
Well, Your Honor, it could. However, as Judge Fox was pointing out, there is no preservation deposition and discovery deposition. And I think that if there is something in a deposition that counsel for the deponent feels is concerning to them, that at that time they should ask questions limited to that if they would like. But certainly there is nothing which precludes the party of the attorney of the deponent from asking questions. And in fact, I've done that in my own case. But for some reason, Front Range lawyers have this folk art or this folklore that there is a discovery deposition and a preservation deposition, and there is no distinction. Rule 27 allows depositions taken before the action starts, but a deposition is a deposition, and if they have a concern about something their client has said, they can then ask that at the end of the deposition.
Counsel, but doesn't allowing the opposing party to conduct their cross-examination after the deposition is presented, doesn't that provide for a more fair trial and a more accurate representation to the fact finder, whether it be the jury or the judge, of this particular witness? Why shouldn't we say that that proceeding is fair?
Well, I think, number one, Your Honor, the conduct of trial is within the discretion of the trial judge. And here the trial judge considered that and denied that request. And I think unless there's a showing that there's an abuse of discretion under that category of what would be considered an abuse of discretion, that discretion should be adhered to. Moreover, because of this particular instance is actually controlled by Rule 32A2. And there is no provision for that. While there was the former rule of 43, that applied to live testimony. And in fact, there is no rule or procedure for saying that once you put in a deposition, that they immediately have the opportunity to get up and then be examined live by their client.
But the rule also doesn't prevent the trial court from exercising its discretion and allowing that questioning to follow immediately after the presentation.
The rule does not, Your Honor.
And in this case, though, the court thought it didn't have any discretion, didn't it?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
I thought from the briefs it said, gee, my interpretation of Rule 32 is it would not permit the court to exercise its discretion to allow that immediate examination.
Well, I think that even if there were that discretion in this case, certainly there's no showing of prejudice, or there's no showing of reversible error. I think that any having them testify, there's no offer of proof that their testimony would have been any different right after the deposition than it was 2 days later. And certainly, if they were going to get up and testify thereafter, would the court have discretion to do that? I think possibly. But I did not understand, and I'll defer here to your recollection of the record, sir, that the judge actually held that they had no discretion, but that under Rule 32, I had a right to read that deposition or play that deposition at the time.
Counsel, so if the trial court allows, in this case, the defense to exercise a strategic choice, and that strategic choice was to play the deposition as opposed to calling a live witness, why shouldn't it allow the same strategic choice to the opposing party if that opposing party wants to have contemporaneous questioning of their client once the deposition has been played or read into the record?
I'm sorry,
why should the trial judge pick sides? Why should it say you, defense, are allowed to make a strategic decision that you'd rather have either, you know, a written deposition or a video deposition. You want to exercise your choice to do that strategically. Why shouldn't they have the same strategic choice of questioning their witness as soon as their testimony is presented?
Well, because the rule provides that as the plaintiff or as the defendant, they could have done it with my client as well. That under Rule 32A2, I'm specifically allowed to use that deposition for any purpose. There is no countervailing part of that rule that says that once the a party who admits that deposition has done so, then the opponent may automatically have their client get up and testify live. And in fact, go ahead, Judge. I see you want to.
Oh, I was just going to ask, are you aware of any other rule that would provide in the detail the procedure of receipt but also response to evidence? Are you aware of any other rule that would contrast with this then, that would say, gee, in that other rule they set up the very procedure or analogous type of procedure, unlike here?
Not off the top of my head, but I would say this, Your Honor, and I would also say that in none of the federal, I mean, this has been a federal rule for a long time. I've gone through the federal rules and there is no case that says that they can then get up and put this on live. I would say that, well, at least in statutory construction, I'm running out of time already, statutory construction that the specific controls over the general, I would say that Rule 32A2 is a specific rule that would take precedent over any other general rule that is certainly not specific to the use of a deposition in trial.
Now, neither party cited Gonzalez v. Harris, which is a Colorado Supreme Court case that came after the Stauffer case. I don't know if you had an opportunity to examine that Supreme Court case.
If I didn't cite it, I'm probably not familiar with it, but
okay.
I'd have to.
But in that case, the Supreme Court indicated its preference for live testimony and also, in fact, said that it would have been an abuse of discretion not to allow the live testimony to be presented. So why shouldn't we follow Gonzalez v. Harris?
Was that, I'm not sure what year that is, Your Honor.
It's after Stauffer.
Okay. And it was in response to deposition testimony?
Correct.
I think that, I guess I'm just not familiar with the case, but the other thing I would say is that at least in this case, there's no showing that any error was anything but harmless because there was no offer of proof showing their testimony would have been any different. And certainly there was nothing, there was no evil intent on my part.
You were not saying that there was any.
Playing the deposition for some tactical maneuver. I would just quickly like to say that with respect to the issues of the cross appeal, that we believe that the trial court did commit error in refusing our instructions with respect to the family car doctrine on the fact that the head of the household may be found to have control of the vehicle by a right of control, even though actual control is not exercised. And I would also suggest that the court committed error. It looks like, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
It's having a hard time.
Oh, okay.
I apologize.
I didn't want to step in when you were about to ask me a question. And also that the trial court committed error by not allowing the jury to hear what the indicia of control is with respect to that exercising a right of control. Because as lawyers, we learn that control is made up of different things, and where lay people may think, well, Mr. Wade had or did not have control of the vehicle. We as lawyers are taught that control is made up of many things as far as the right of control, that he purchased the vehicle, he purchased the, paid the money for the license, for the gas, the maintenance, and other things. And through that, the courts of appeal have taught us as lawyers, this is what you have to prove to show a right of control. And that's why I brought that in.
But didn't the trial court allow you to present that evidence and then also to make argument in closing regarding control?
They allowed that evidence to come in, yes, Judge Fox, but the question is that is really a hollow statement if the court doesn't say, when you're considering this right of control, you want to consider these factors. They don't know as lay people why this evidence was being brought in. And to tell you the truth, I did not argue in final argument the family car doctrine because of the fact that when the judge was with my next error, when the judge instructed with respect to the definition of the head of the household, That instruction was contrary to the law, because that instruction on the head of the household from the CJI is that whichever spouse stays at home and calls the plumber and does the decorating and picks out the furniture, that that is the head of the household rather than the primary wage earner.
It was in my household.
Mr. Talk about the legal head of the household. I agree with you, Ryan, but I'm using the legal definition, which is historic.
Mr. Hedberg, was the jury advised that there could be more than one head of the household?
They were, Your Honor, but they were not told that the head of the household is the primary wage earner, because the whole purpose of the family car doctrine is to make that person who is, whether it's the male or the female, who is best able to respond in damages. And with the CJI instruction, it makes that person who is the least able to respond in damages as the head of the household. As the jury picked down, it said Mr. Ray was not the head of the household, but he was earning, according to this, $125,000 a month.
Did they make, was there a special interrogatory
yes.
where they answered he was not the head of the household?
I have that, and I can give you the citation, Your Honor, to the record. It is 2043 is the special interrogatory where they said Mr. Whaley did not have control of the vehicle, which is another part of our argument on why I feel that the issues on control should have been. And also, and I'll tell you, this is my fault. I missed two citations, and but that Lee versus Degler, which is cited in the CJI, and also Ross versus Douglas, both say head of the household is the primary wage earner.
Boom. We normally don't bring up cases for purposes of oral argument unless we've alerted the other side that you're going to discuss those cases.
They were in my brief.
Oh, I thought you said they were not in.
Then
I apologize to you.
No, they were both, Ross versus Degler was in.
But did you alert the trial court to those?
I did not.
Okay.
I did not. I missed that.
And I apologize then, counsel.
Go ahead. That's all right. My last issue would be with respect to Rule 69 interrogatories, and I would just briefly say that I think that the discovery rules allow us a broad inquiry into their assets, that we should be permitted to trace those assets, and that contrary to what the trial judge held in ruling on our motion to compel, our allowance to trace these assets was certainly fixed and frozen at the day of the collision, because the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act would then freeze those assets at that time. The trial judge said we were only allowed to look into their assets at the time of the filing of the, his filing of the judgment.
Mr. Heckberg, the trial judge said that that Mrs. Whaley didn't have to respond as to jointly held assets, and cited a statute that was part of the probate code. Do you know why the judge relied on that statute?
I think the judge was mistaken. I think not only is it part of the probate code, Judge Robin, but it's a particular banking statute that's not applicable to any other banks in the United States other than Colorado banks. But I agree with your part about the probate code, and that certainly there are exceptions to that. And because it's, because it is a contravention of the common law, that's a statute that has to be strictly construed, and that it only applies to, if you're going to apply it, only applies to bank assets, not money market, not other financial. And thank you for your time and courtesy.
Thank you for your argument, counsel.
I am not seeing if the case is it Lee versus Degler. Is it
Pardon me?
Lee versus Degler? I'm not seeing that in the briefs. I mean, I have an idea of what it says, but
hold on. Okay, go ahead, counsel, on that. This is Lee versus Degler.
I don't believe that case was cited. In fact, what I said that was amended as a part of the jury instruction.
Okay. Future counsel. Thank you. Mr. Epstein, do you need any time to respond to that in writing? If you want it, we will give you some time. If not, we will go on with the case.
Can I have 5 days and I'll either respond or advise that I don't need to respond?
How about by Friday? So it's 4 days. I guess it's 5 days. By close of business on Friday, 2 pages to discuss this case.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
And just for purpose of clarification for everybody here, my understanding, Mr. Heckert, is that you cited two cases to us. One of them was Lee v. Degler, and the other is Ross v. Douglas. And the Ross v. Douglas case does appear that it's as if it's cited in your brief.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Epstein, is that consistent with your understanding as well?
Yes.
So it's only the one case that you would need to respond concerning?
Okay. Go ahead.
Just one point. There was a discussion about whether the trial court exercised discretion to defer defendant's live testimony until defendant's case in chief. That's not what happened. What happened was defense counsel filed a motion to permit defendants to be called live immediately after their depositions were played for the jury. Plaintiff's counsel opposed it, arguing that Rule 32 and Stouffer v. Caravan precluded the trial court from doing that. And the original trial judge agreed in a pretrial order defense motion denied. I sympathize with defendant's position, but essentially I don't have the discretion to allow you to do that. That's why we're arguing this was not a discretionary decision based on streamlining the case or judicial economy. It's a case in which the trial court misinterpreted Rule 32 and Caravan. There are no cases on point on this, but nothing in Rule 32 precludes what defendants are arguing should be permitted as a matter of course when plaintiffs employ this tactic.
Or authorizes it, for that sake. Nothing in Rule 32, okay.
Nothing precludes it, nothing authorizes it.
Mr. Epstein, before you run out of time, I'd just like to ask you a question similar to what I asked Mr. Heckert about the responses to the interrogatories. Do you know on what basis the trial court judge relied on Section 1515.211 to say that Mrs. Whaley did not have to respond regarding jointly held marital assets?
Boy, I'm sorry, I do not remember what the judge said, what the trial judge said about that. I just don't recall.
I have one question still: is if Mrs. Whaley is subject now to the judgment, why is it not permissible to discover those assets in which she holds a joint interest? They can't be executed on by the judgment creditor?
Well, Mrs. Whaley's discovery responses did, the court held that she did respond to the interrogatories to the extent they were relevant to discovering information regarding her financial interest.
How about the joint interest? How about the joint property? Did she respond identifying the joint property?
I think that she did. There was a house that was identified, and there's a whole bunch of interrogatories, but she did respond.
If she didn't respond or didn't have to respond, would that have been error? To jointly held property?
It would have been error to the extent that the inquiry was directed to discovery of information that could lead to admissible evidence, but I think that the trial judge carefully tailored its order to restrict the discovery to what was to preclude discovery that could only have been relevant to Mr. Whaley's assets.
In addition to the interrogatories, there was also extensive questioning during deposition about assets, correct?
I'm only remembering the issue on appeal being answers to interrogatories, Rule 69 interrogatories. Thank you.
I thank counsel, both counsel, for their excellent arguments today. And I want to, the case will stand submitted and opinion will issue in due course. But thank you both.